You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, May 22nd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Today on the program, it's Casual Friday, folks. I started off today's program doing the Michael. You got to be on YouTube to see that, but I'm sure there'll be screen grabs. It's Casual Friday. You know what that means? Cliff Schechter will be joining us to go over the week's news or some topic of something that happened this week. Also on the program today, I'm very excited, Barry Crimmins, political satirist, one of the guys who wrote it, Air America. That's probably the least of his claims to fame. Also on the program today, the Senate going to be in session through Memorial Day weekend, supposedly, trying to figure out how they're going to reauthorize the Patriot Act, even though a federal court has said it's bulk collection illegal. Meanwhile, CNN and Fox announce their debate criteria for the Republican debates. There's going to be, 45, I think, people participating in those Republican debates. And so they had to come up with a criteria already. Rick Santorum is doing the Michael, or is pouting, I should say. And we spoke about this in the past, but an update on just how vicious, I mean, sociopathic the Kansas lawmakers and government is towards people living in poverty. And for the first time, at least in, nearly 20 years that Gallup has been measuring this, more Americans self-ID as liberal than conservatives. Or it's tied, I think. It's fascinating. Folks, on Wednesday, yesterday I was out, I went with my daughter to Staten Island with her elementary school class to Old Richmond Town, which turns out to be the second oldest continuous historical village, I guess, in the country, after Jamestown in Virginia. And it was interesting, but also sort of bizarre, because it's in the middle of Staten Island and literally like bordered by sort of very strange Staten Island suburban-y type of thing. And then you go into this like one little, 6-block area, and it's buildings from the 1700s. And this was founded in the 1600s. And it also looks like there's been no money put into the place since, the late 1600s. It looks very, it was weird. I'll talk more about that later in the program to the extent that there's anything of interest. But on Wednesday, one of the last things we were talking about, at least in the fun half of the show, was how relevant, maybe it was in the early half, I can't remember, how relevant this part of the fast track authority, where Democrats wanted the TAA to be part of fast track authority, in other words, a trade assistance bill, which would retrain workers, which would provide extra unemployment for people who lost their job because of trade. And apparently, the bill that was put forth was by Republicans who are paying for that by cutting $700 million off of Medicare. Now, granted, it's about 10 years out. Nevertheless, this would set a precedent that you can go to Medicare as a piggy bank. And we were talking on Wednesday that hopefully there'll be some organizations out there or people who are fighting against the TPP and Fast Track Authority will use this as leverage to scare some Democrats in the House so that the Republicans need to convince more of their folks to vote. And also, I would imagine, scare some Republicans. I mean, cutting $700 million off of Medicare is a big problem. Well, literally moments after the show ended, I saw this story in Huffington Post. Progressive activist group Credo Action is targeting congressional Democrats with a new online ad campaign accusing them of supporting Medicare cuts by backing major trade legislation pushed by President Obama and Republican leaders. And the Credo Action ads accuse lawmakers of cutting Medicare pay to the fast track bill will target Senators Ron Wyden, Mark Warner, Ron Kind, Earl Blumhauer, and Ame Barrera. Ron Johnson, as the lone Republican, will be featured in the first round of advertising. All Democrats except for one Republican. And I mention this both because it was a fairly obvious thing that somebody should do. But Credo is sponsoring the program this month, and this is exactly why I get excited about Credo sponsoring the program. I mean, there are some products that we talk about that are interesting products. You know, get some pair of socks online. That's great. But Credo Action, which is funded by Credo Mobile, is an organization that I've been aware of and have interviewed people from there for years and years, and I'm extremely happy to support and extremely happy that they're supporting this program for things exactly like this. They're willing to go after Democrats, and they're willing to go to leverage points that others aren't. And like I say, they are funded by Credo Mobile. Credo Mobile is sponsoring this program this month. They're given a great deal to Majority Report listeners. You go to credomobile.com/majority report. $100 off of any phone, plus 25% off your data for the first year. If you're in a contract right now, they will buy you out. They'll give you a credit on your future credit, your Credo bill, up to $350 per line. If you are charged that by, you know, canceling early with an early termination fee. And they'll also give you a $300 trade-in for your current phone. You go to credomobile.com/trade-in to find out how much it's worth. But go to credomobile.com/majority report. Check out the deal. It only is happening, I think it's going to last the whole month, but it's happening right now. You can also call 800-966-1665. Use the coupon code 501-882. You can get all that information on our website. But credomobile.com/majority report. This is why I am proud that they're a sponsor of this program. They should also have let me know beforehand that they were going out and do that. But, that's why I read it. As soon as it comes out, they got more fish, important fish to fry, but very excited about it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Cliff Schechter. Don't forget, you can also support the program by becoming a member today at majority.fm. We'll talk about the other stuff later. We'll be right back with Cliff Schechter. We are back. Ladies and gentlemen, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure. It is always a treat. It's always what makes Casual Friday sort of like, I don't know, sort of like your birthday in a way. That just happens to fall every Friday. One, here is the song that is basically like happy birthday to you, but obviously it's not your birthday, so we have this.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Hello, Cliff. How are you?
I am doing swell. How about you, Sam?
I am terrified, Cliff. I am terrified.
You are?
Yes, because I have
I think
a.
I know why you're terrified.
Well, I have a computer, and I am looking at Twitter, and
clearly you're one of those modern people.
I am one of those modern people. Lindsey Graham has tweeted out that we have never seen more threats against our nation and its citizens than we do today.
Not just never, but never, ever, ever, never.
Never. And
it is. It's scary. I mean, if you look at the whole history of this country, clearly we've never seen anything like this. No one's ever attacked us here. There never was a war, you know, for lack of a better term, that was civil.
Mm-hmm.
If you were certain kinds of Americans, like let's say Native American or African American, you've never had anything that's, I mean, life's been pretty cheery overall. No one's ever attacked you. I can't think of any real wars we've had. So he's right.
Apparently there was a time
war thing,
back
right?
in the 60s where we were rather close to an all-out nuclear war, is my understanding too.
But would the nuclear missiles that have hit us had ISIS guys on them?
Right.
No, they wouldn't have brought ISIS to America the way clearly President Obama's adherence to the Muslim Brotherhood is doing right now.
Now Lindsey Graham is obviously running for president. And, you know, he's
king of the closet
or I should say running for the vice presidency. And
when I said the closet, by the way, I meant, you know, he may have left some things in there, like clothing.
Mm.
And so he might have to go look for it. And that's all I was getting at.
To be clear.
He's
running for the vice presidency and, you know, and doing so as the sort of, I guess, the expert on trying to terrify the American people and drum up some type of threat. But what's interesting, the reason why I raise that, because, you know, look, Lindsey Graham does that, it seems to me, every, I don't know, every 6 weeks he says that. And yeah. And has literally been saying that for at least, you know, 15 years almost now.
Yep.
That I am aware of.
No, but, I mean, certainly, I mean, I don't know if he was probably saying it when he was in the House, right around when he was impeaching that threat, Bill Clinton.
Right.
But I don't know if anybody was listening much, but certainly since he's been in the Senate, which is around at least 10 years now, right? He's you know, joined the McCain caucus and can't shut up about how the world's coming to an end.
Now, what's interesting about this is because this is exactly the rhetoric we saw that led us into the war in Iraq. I mean, literally the same type of rhetoric, the same type of hyperbole. Obviously, it had more resonance then for the American public because we were so close to 9/11 and people, I think, were still in state of shock. But I raise this because you know, a couple of weeks ago, with Jeb Bush in the race, we are seeing a lot of, you know, the question of Iraq, and I guess also with ISIS taking Ramadi this week, which is, I think, it's not indicative of anything good, but one should remember Ramadi is the capital of the Anbar province, which is essentially where it was Saddam Hussein's hometown, more or less. I mean, I guess it was Tikrit was his hometown, but it was the epicenter of Saddam Hussein's power, and it is the epicenter of those who were de-Baathified and all those Baathist generals, and many of whom are leading or ISIS in many respects. Michael and I were talking about the Fedayeen, which, of course, was sort of like Saddam Hussein's version of the National Guard or the Palace Guards.
Or and, the Republican Guard.
Yeah, exactly. Iran. And so, this is – we're hearing a lot more about Iraq and the stunning to me, the revisionist history that's going on.
Yes. So I'd like to quickly move from the comedy of making fun of Lindsey Graham to outrage, if that's okay.
Please.
Here we are sitting here, you know, 12 years later after these people made the biggest blunder in the history of the United States. I mean, certainly at least comparable to Vietnam, if not worse. And this is a guy who's taken seriously, who stands up and says things like this. He was wrong about everything. Everything. All right. He wasn't as complicit as George W. Bush was, as far as we know, anyhow, and his administration in the stovepiping of intelligence, in making up false claims about yellow cake in Niger, and then outing an undercover agent who, by the way, her job was to stop proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in Iran, was one of the main things she was doing. And all the other ways in which these guys threatened, intimidated, lied, planted stories. And so that now a bunch of people could say, oh, well, the intelligence was bad. Well, some of the intelligence was bad because clearly even people who weren't part of that little junta thought that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, there are plenty of us out there. I didn't know you, I don't think, back then, Sam, but I'm going to guess you were among them, who said, what if they do have weapons of mass destruction? Russia had them, or the Soviet Union, for years, and you see, we didn't go to war with them. If there's a secular leader there in Saddam Hussein who cares about his life, which clearly he did, you can actually deter them, right? It's pretty simple. We've done that before. So this whole idea of taking out the leadership with nothing to replace it with is idiotic just to begin with, in simple foreign policy terms. But once again, these guys have proven that they don't know anything. They don't know their whatever's from a hole in the ground. And yet this guy is sitting there making the same case and trying to get us to go back into Iraq and fight ISIS, to get us to go into Syria, to get us to go into Iran. And it's just amazing that he has a microphone and the ability to run for president to do this, because these guys don't know anything. They are the stupidest people. Their foreign policy theories, all the we can go in on the cheap and the oil will pay for it and the flowers and the chocolates, all fell apart. What happened is anybody, any student of history and foreign policy would understand, whether you want to look in recent years or go back to, you know, I don't know, go back to, how about the Philippines during the Spanish-American War, where both the Spanish and we failed to colonize. You can't go in and occupy a place on the cheap and just think, yeah, they're going to be happy to have us there, particularly if it's people who don't have a shared cultural history and are completely come from a different background than you do. It will not work. All right. The only way it ever works at all is post-World War II. If you think about Japan and Germany and some others, where we are still there. And we pumped a lot of money, tons of money, into those countries. We traded with them, often at a disadvantage to ourselves. We built infrastructure. We did a lot of things, none of which we were willing to ever do in Iraq, and which, by the way, you know, to be even-handed here, we won't do in Libya either. Now, that clearly wasn't as big a mistake, because President Obama's not as much of a jackass as these guys are and not as stupid as they are, but that was another place we've created a vacuum now. And look, that's not working either. We can try it as many times as we want. It will never work unless we suddenly say we are going to take billions of dollars and invest in these places to give people jobs and to make them want to embrace the way of life we want them to embrace, but we will never be willing to invest that. So we will create a vacuum, and into that vacuum will step ISIS or other characters like that. It's simple common sense. But this guy wants to be president on that record, on that failed, ridiculous record. It's just amazing to me. It's astounding.
And it's not, and we should be clear, it's not, look, there's a lot of people who have a great investment in making sure that the history of how we went into Iraq is obscured and rewritten. All right. And I mean, let's just take that first. There's a couple of different good arguments that I've seen out there in terms of what is important to remind people of. And you're right. I mean, as late, I guess, as February of 2003. In fact, this show, the first Majority Report that ever took place, was Tom Sharpling giving me 2 hours on the best show on FMU to go out there and live do a version of this show. I mean, if people think that what I do now is even slightly unprofessional, back then it was pretty stunning. But nevertheless, the argument was the same. We should not be going into Iraq. And the arguments are, and in fact, those arguments have been bolstered since that time. The first being that when the administration talked about weapons of mass destruction, the words weapons of mass destruction have been so conflated and so manipulated.
Yeah.
The idea at the time, and look, anything that I knew at that time was a function of it being written by a reporter, right? I mean, I never had any sources that anybody else didn't have. It's just that I was taking the time to look.
Right. Well, let's say additionally, Sam, we knew the history. So if you knew the history in Iraq, there was reason you could believe that Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons because he had used them.
Yes.
And so
we had given them. Donald Rumsfeld brought them over on a truck practically. But the bottom line is that a ton of sarin gas on a battlefield kills about 100 people. And
right.
This is a weapon of mass destruction, definitionally speaking, it was not what the American public thought it was.
No, when they conflated that with mushroom cloud quite purposely.
Yes.
To create the impression that there were nuclear weapons there, which is something that no one ever believed. No legitimate source that I'm aware of, and that Joe Wilson took apart when they tried to pretend. And the Italian, I don't know if it's the Italian Secret Service, the Italian version of the CIA took a look at these documents that supposedly said that they tried to purchase this yellow cake from Niger, and were like, this is ridiculous. And Joe Wilson, of course, wrote about that when he went there and checked it out. And then there's the rest of that history. But, you know, one could be forgiven for believing they had chemical weapons, right? They'd used them, and it wasn't impossible to believe that. And there was bad intelligence on
that. Well, there's no doubt in my mind that the administration, thought that they would find chemical weapons in Iraq.
And
why
yet,
wouldn't you?
And yet, and plenty of people have chemical weapons, and we always believe that we can deter them.
But here's
many
the bottom line is, that did not in any way, the existence of chemical weapons there would not in any way be an existential threat to the United States. It wouldn't even be a threat to significant portions of any large city. I mean, yes, it would be bad if somebody released, figured out a way of aerolizing sarin gas and somehow getting it to a New York public subway system and releasing it, and you'd probably have, I don't know.
I don't get it. North Korea has worse. Why haven't we invaded them?
You'd have the same amount of people die, maybe as died in that shootout in Waco, Texas the other day. I mean, look, the bottom line is that this was never an existential threat to the country. But then let's go beyond that, okay? Leave that aside. We know this whole thing where if we knew then what we knew now, they knew then. The Bush administration lied about the intelligence. They knew they were lying about the intelligence.
For the first time in the history of this country that I'm aware of, certainly what people who are legitimate sources out there have said, they created the stove piping was the term. They didn't, you know, that Dick Cheney kept firing the people they sent over to give him the daily brief because he didn't want to hear. It's pretty clear when you're firing people, kind of like it's pretty clear when you're outing undercover agents, the message you're sending, it's not just about that person. It's about what you're telling everybody else as to what's acceptable. Criticize us in public, we'll destroy your life. Come to me with the information I don't want to see, you'll be fired. This is really easy stuff. And when we know that Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, right after 9/11, were talking to Richard Clark and saying, well, there are no good targets to hit in Afghanistan, so why don't we just bomb a completely different place?
Specifically Iraq.
Right. Well, that's what I meant by different place. Of course, Richard Pearl had 8 other countries on his list, too, in the book he wrote. Iraq was the beginning. Somalia, Iran, Syria, you know, you go on forever because that's what we should do with our time, our money, and our morality, or lack thereof. And so we know these guys, that's what they said, and oh, let's go bomb Iraq. And George W. Bush had a variety of reasons to do it, and Paul, you know, because of his dad and because of other reasons, and Wolfowitz believed that his stupid, inane theory of how a democracy could just spring up in a place that didn't have that tradition and didn't have that history and didn't have the structures to put that in place was put, you know, that was another reason. We'll create democracy in the Middle East, and George Bush, I think, believed that would happen too. You know, I mean, it was like all these ridiculously stupid theories with no historical proof, no scientific proof, nothing, all sort of combined to lead to what we did. And every one of them, of course, was proven to be wrong. The whole thing failed.
But it wasn't wrong. Look, the bottom line was, this is the fundamental, and James Fallows makes this point too, and you've said it, but I want to reiterate this. And for people who don't understand, you know, I think there's a lot of people who listen to this audience. They are fully versed in how one manipulates that intelligence. Let me just remind people that if you wanted to, if you sat in the White House right now and you demanded by explicitly or implicitly, I want intelligence to show that, in fact, there are lizard people walking amongst us. There is no doubt in my mind at the CIA there is a file where somebody has been interviewed who claims that there are lizard people walking amongst us.
The
reality is there's a lot more files that say there are no lizard people. That guy is not a credible source. But if you keep saying, like you say, you show up at this White House, and if I got to go down to the CIA 5 times and visit as Cheney did and make sure that that file ends up being brought to my desk, and that is considered the intelligence, and that's exactly what they did. They did not allow.
Let me say one other thing too, which is, you know, two other things quickly. First of all, in addition to all of that, the whole case that was made there, where you know somehow Saddam Hussein was connected to these people who hated him because he was secular and he was not a radical Islamist in the manner in which they were. So of course he was, you know, he wasn't going to work with them, you know. What's his name? Zakari, who was in northern Iraq, was aligned with them, not aligned with Saddam Hussein, not friends. But the way they made this was Dick Cheney, after being definitively told that this BS report about Mohammed Atta going and meeting in Prague with some of the Iraqi intelligence, this was confirmed. This in so many cases, he was told that this was just utter crap. And it was there was literally no legitimacy to this. And then he went on Meet the Press and other shows months after that and kept repeating it. So if he wants to believe he wasn't purposely lying to get us into that war, that if you look at those facts, they don't jive, okay? It doesn't make any sense unless he's lying his way into that war. They knew this stuff. And so it's not just intelligence failures, of which, yes, there were some. These guys did it. But the final point I want to make on this, and I'm not saying we need to stop talking about this, but from my perspective is, this is the failure again. This is where it shows up, the failure of the strategy of President Obama to look forward and not backward.
Yep.
Because the reason why Lindsey Graham can run for president is because no one has ever been held accountable for this. If the people who had perpetrated the acts, who started a war based on lies, who committed torture and broke UN conventions and our own constitution and the rest, if they'd been held accountable for these actions, if some of these people went to prison, if at least there were high-profile trials, okay, then Lindsey Graham would have been under the microscope for the lies that he told that were fed to him. Maybe we'd know more if he knew what he was talking about and was lying or just didn't know and was repeating what was fed to him. Either way, he would have a lot to answer for now, which he doesn't need to answer for nearly as much. I mean, we just had the first circumstances where Republicans have come out and said they wouldn't do it again if because of what Jeb Bush said and the other guys to make Jeb Bush look bad. No, we wouldn't do it again with that intelligence. And Rubio went so far as to say George W. Bush wouldn't have done it. Well, yeah, he would have. And they've gotten away with all of it because we looked forward.
And even I think this is even incumbent upon Hillary Clinton. Even though she has said more or less the same thing, even though she recanted that vote years ago, I still think it's incumbent upon her to say, like, this is the lesson I've learned. This is why I would not, and these are the circumstances in which I would not invade a country.
I wouldn't even, and frankly, Sam, I wouldn't even just single her out. I would also say John Kerry. I would also say Joe Biden.
Yes, but she's running for president. And John Kerry's.
I'm talking about way back when Biden was running for vice president, it would have been nice.
We
didn't go another 7 years without talking about this. When John Kerry, maybe it was too soon to know everything when he was running for president, but certainly as a major figure in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that we've let this go so many years without these guys forcefully.
Look, they knew John Kerry took that vote out of cowardice. Hillary Clinton took that vote out of maybe cowardice, maybe, you know, not having as much of a problem with a war like that. In my, it was a calculation, yes, but I'm not convinced that it won. That was like so difficult for her to make in terms of where she is in terms of foreign policy. All that said, because and the reason why I say that is because they knew they were opening the door, and yes, the vote was just to basically empower the president, blah blah, blah, but they knew. They knew. James Fallows writes about on 9/11, 9/12, he spoke to someone in the Pentagon who said, we're going after Iraq. Everybody knows it. And there's no way they didn't know that this wasn't on the back burner anyways. And there's just no way.
I think the reason why we've had the decay and why John McCain has been allowed to remain a voice in foreign policy and why Lindsey Graham can run for president is that all these people we're talking about weren't held responsible.
Nobody was held accountable.
But also on the Democratic side, anyone who was that high profile, anyone who was the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who became vice president, who became secretary of state, these are all people who should have had to come out, not just say why they voted the way they did, but explain what happened. Recant and explain and say why it was wrong and say why they won't make the same mistake again.
Right. Absolutely.
That's an important part of our history that a lot of, as you said, even Democrats, because about what, only, I mean, how many Democrats voted for it? I'm losing my history now, but enough.
In the Senate, plenty.
And 30, I think.
Yes. And we should say that I totally agree with you that when President Obama said, you know, turn the page, move forward, don't look back, unless, of course, it's something that we should look back on. Do all of that. Basically, he was creating a vacuum, and he was the history was not settled. There was never a time, and so when you allow time to pass, when Judy Miller can walk around and sell her book, and it becomes an argument as to whether or not what she did was fundamentally unethical.
And she's defending them, too. She's blaming it all on bad intelligence.
Of course.
She's telling the same damn story they are.
Of course, because there's a vacuum that's been created, because the only, theoretically, in the context of our system, the only party or entity that could have held these people accountable decided not to. And so you basically say it's open season. And I want to remind people that regardless of whether or not people thought they were hoodwinked, there was weapons inspectors on the ground at the time that we started the attack. Well, the Bush administration said
to
the UN, get them out, get them out. And they would have been in there if we had not said, we're about to bomb, get them out. So,
that's right. I mean, yeah. And the irony of this, all of this also, is that some of the most vocal critics of the president, by not looking back, he's allowed them to remain in their perches, most notably Dick Cheney, where they can write, you know, books that are full of it and go out on little tours with their daughter when she's not getting kicked out of Senate races in Wyoming, and hurt him, frankly, with the things they say about him that a conservative audience wants to hear.
Yep.
But, you know, he's allowed them to retain the credibility, you know, and many others along those lines in the Senate and in the House, and your Bill Kristols and you know, people like that out there who write for major publications and go on TV, and it's created, you know, it's allowed these guys to continue to exist and never have to apologize for what they did. And so they've had more legitimacy when they've been in the mainstream media criticizing him.
Yep. Yep. All right. Let's move on. I'm torn here. I want to talk about Jeb Bush a little bit in terms of global warming, and I want to get into these debates thing, because I do think it's fascinating to try and even guess like how insane things are going to be 6 months from now. But I also was interviewed by had a conversation with a reporter from Politico and about Martin O'Malley, you know, who.
Yeah.
I guess Martin O'Malley is just, you know, sort of wondering, like, why the progressive base is not as excited about him.
Suit, I think.
What's that?
He's going to declare in about a week, I think.
Yeah.
He's running.
And I think, you know, there's some sense in the O'Malley campaign, like, why isn't the base as excited about us as they are about Elizabeth
Warren? You know what's
funny? What?
Is I'm 100% positive I know who that political reporter is you talked to.
Yes. Well, I mean, to be honest with you, off the top of my head, I couldn't in a million years tell you his name. At one point we got disconnected and I called back and the number on the phone, and he must have been calling from some, I don't know where it was, but they answered the phone and I didn't recognize. And I realized, like, because I just assumed it was his cell phone or something, and I realized I don't know the guy's name. And so I said, just wrong number. And I just waited for him to call me back. So I don't know if we should talk about that. Maybe we'll save that for next week.
O'Malley? Why don't we talk about O'Malley next week? Because we'll be right before
his
announcement.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So let's talk about this.
I want to talk about that though, because it is a fascinating, just looking at his record, because he's certainly moved somewhat to the left and wasn't that far to the left in the past.
To me, it has to do with a sort of a fundamental sort of populist perspective that I will say this reporter, I think, clearly does not. It is interesting because I don't deal with people like this on any type of even semi-regular basis. And the myopia is fascinating to me.
So let's discuss that. But we need to look into the mind of your average Republican voter, if we dare,
minutes. Let's talk about this. So Jeb Bush, who, if I'm not mistaken, the big sort of upshot of Jeb Bush was at least he acknowledges that climate change is man-made, and he's not virulently anti-Latino. And he seems to have, like, you know, tried to downplay his immigration position. But he has just done, as far as I can tell, like a full on 360 now, or 180 on climate change.
Well, what he's done is, and this seems to be like the conservative version of middle ground, of being a moderate, which is you know, tells you all you need to know in and of itself. But that is to say, yes, the Earth is warming, but we don't have enough studies yet to know that it's because of humans. So it may just be like it's happened in the past, man. I mean, you know, there were ice ages and crazy stuff happens, and where's your baseline? And they cherry pick data depending upon what date they start measuring, you know, and that kind of thing, and say, yeah, who knows, man? It's, you know, it's not necessarily humans, and sure, we may contribute to this, but we don't know, as if 97% of peer-reviewed studies haven't exactly said that. And my guess is the other 3% of peer-reviewed studies, if you looked far enough, you'd find some Exxon money behind them. So, or Coke money, or both. So I mean, that's the thing, is that he said, he actually used the term arrogant. And the only thing arrogant is for him to think that with his little pea brain, he knows more than 97% of the scientists out there
now,
who have said this is directly attributable to human behavior and carbon in the atmosphere.
All right. Well, let's also be frank about this. Jeb Bush does not believe what he's saying.
Of course not.
So he, this is just posturing. This is really more a reflection of, you know, that what we can garner from this is a couple of things. One is, of course, that the people that he has to appeal to are morons and insane. But I will also add, this is where you can parse out quite easily, it seems to me, the dog whistle to the fundamentalist base. He says two things that is being reported. They said. One, he says, for the people to say the science is decided on this is really arrogant, to be honest with you. It's this intellectual arrogance that now you can't have a conversation about it even. Okay, there's two things going on here.
I also don't converse with people about gravity.
What? Right. Well, that would be very intellectually arrogant of you.
Yes,
there's two things going on here. One is, it's the elite eggheads, blah, blah, blah,
Nattering nabobs of negativism and all that crap.
But there's something else going on here, because to say it's really arrogant is there's another way where this goes. And that is, it is arrogant. It is profane for humans to think that they have the ability to impact what is God's realm.
That's,
I mean,
exactly
this is
right.
this appeals to both sort of the cultural conservatives who have a chip on their shoulder because those liberals think they're so much smarter than us, and it appeals to the fundamentalists. This is
exactly
very
right
tested,
that.
Very tested language. And
yeah, right.
and so he's trying to hit both those sort of quadrants, which, you know, to be honest, they overlap quite a bit, but both those quadrants.
But what leads them, you're exactly right. They overlap, as many, you know, groups do. And you've also got your anti-government types, and you've also got your business conservatives that don't want to be regulated. The point is that all these different groups, in the end, are happy with what he says. Many of them overlap. They don't all fully overlap. But he reaches all of them in saying that. In the end, I think, to me, still, he can use all the poll-tested language he wants. He just is another reason, when we've seen many of them recently, just shows why he's such a terrible candidate, which I had no idea. I mean, I think the name Bush and a bunch of money was enough to get it done in Florida, quite frankly. But on the national stage, he's terrible. I mean, he doesn't just lack charisma. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, there's a theory that it was easy for George W. Bush to stay on message because he was so dumb. You know what I mean? So he didn't have other, you know, complicated thoughts passing through his mind. But, you know, Bill Clinton's very smart, and he was able to stay on message in an amazing way. Jeb Bush is all over the place, I don't know. I've been so unimpressed by him. I think he's out of it before it even starts.
Interesting. I tend to agree with you. He's rusty, and I've been saying this for a long time. But, you know, it's not like the narrative is that there's some huge deep bench here because there's so many people. But the reality is, I think this bench might be quite wide, but I don't know how deep it is, per se. There's a lot of people on that bench. It goes way down the dugout, but none of these people are particularly good, it seems to me. But we have to go, because I got again, we'll talk to Barry Crimmins in a second. We got a lot to talk about in the coming weeks, Cliff. So, as always, I really appreciate your coming on.
My pleasure, man. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Cliff Schecter. Boom, boom. All right, we're going to take a break. And just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. Pennies a day, ladies and gentlemen, for what many consider the single best political podcast in existence in the world. Some people think it's number two or three, but they're wrong. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Free shipping now they have. Free shipping. Get the Majority Report blend. Of course, that link can be found along with all our show sponsor links at support the show or support our sponsors at majority.fm. And also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Don't forget the Credo offer at credomobile.com/majorityreport. It's a great offer for Majority Report listeners. And during the break, if you want to go to our YouTube page, I will be doing the Michael again, the Michael pose. It is when Michael is upset. And if we, I don't know, maybe we'll do some contest where, hold on for 1 second, Michael, don't worry. This is, maybe we'll do some contest in the future for in the better half of the show where if you get like some type of trivia question, I will send you the picture of Michael through the keyhole, the people in the hallway looking exasperated. But we got to take a break. When we come back, Barry Crimmins. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a real pleasure for me to welcome to the program someone who was on the original Majority Report on Air America at least a couple of times, and I know on some of my subsequent shows on radio, and I don't frankly know why it has taken me this long to have him on this program. Barry Crimmins.
Neither do I.
I honestly, Barry, like I, you know, I was like, wait a second, is it possible that we haven't had Barry on? And it's ridiculous. And so let me just say that was a mistake. And we're going to have you on as, you know, more often, hopefully, if you will come.
Anytime. Love the show.
Now let me just, I want to just tell people, you know, and I don't know.
Wait,
if
can I get in 2 comments on what you were already talking about today?
Sure, please.
First off, I think it's clear that Jeb Bush at least believes in political climate change. And secondly, the only intelligence that could have kept us out of the Iraq war was native intelligence. So, thank you.
Indeed. And you know, I'll tell you something. Let me just back up for a second so the people, we can put this sort of in context. I started doing comedy in Boston in 1990, 1991. Uh-huh. And I was, you know, at that time, I think we were going into Kuwait for the first time or sometime around then.
Right,
maybe it was
a little bit later.
Right. And
it was World War I of the Gulf Wars. It was the, if you hadn't had that one, you wouldn't have had to have any of the subsequent ones.
And in some ways, it was sort of like training ground, too, I think, for the American public as to what we were willing to do in that in the Middle East. But you were one of the few clubs I would do open mics at was Catch a Rising Star. And you were a huge force in Boston comedy, certainly way before I got there, with starting the Ding Ho. And if anybody knows anything about comedy, the Ding Ho is a legendary place where guys like Stephen Wright came out of, and Meany and Lenny Clark. And that was a room that you ran.
I started it, yeah. Produced the shows.
And for me, and I don't know if I told you this when we were at Air America together, but so much of what I did at that time and so much where I started in comedy sort of came out of just, you know, I don't think I took any of your material, but you were an inspiration insofar as like what could be done on a comedy stage. And very few people were doing what you were doing at that time.
Yes, and considering how it worked out for me, we understand why. But no, but then again, I was doing what I was supposed to be doing, Sam, and everybody should do what they're supposed to do. Like, you figured that out and you did it, and I'm glad that what I did served as an indication that you could certainly go ahead and do what you were going to do. But a lot of comics apologize to me for not doing my kind of act. It's like, no, you're really funny and you do what you do, and that's great. You know, that's, I don't expect everybody to do what I do. It's hard, and, you know, people don't want to hear about it a lot of the time.
I would watch you in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was theoretically, right, the least hostile place, I think, for the things that you were talking about. And there were still times, even in the basement of a place in Harvard Square, where you were met with some hostility.
Sure.
But let me get your sense. I mean, I want to talk about some other stuff, too, obviously, and Call Me Lucky, the film that of which you're a subject of. But do you think it's changed? I mean, my sense is that, and particularly, and I should also say that we ended up at Air America together as well, where you were writing for all, many of the shows there. And even then, there was a lot more hostility to comedians being political, it seems to me. I mean, do you think it's changed?
Well, here's the thing, Sam, and this always sticks in my craw, and that is that if you're progressive and you're political as a comic, you're labeled as political. But if you're reinforcing the oppressive status quo, if you're misogynist, if you're racist, if you're, you're just fun. And it's not, that doesn't count in the political spectrum. But if you go out there and you make jokes about, you know, beating women or, you know, whatever it is, that's a political statement as far as I'm concerned. And if anything, you know, the vast majority of political statements that are made on comedy stages just aren't progressive statements. But they're not labeled as political.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's because the oppressive status quo isn't threatened by them, so it just seems normal and part of the fun, and you're just reinforcing stuff and pushing easy buttons and so on and so forth. And in a lot of cases these days, you get to be called a rebel because you're really in favor of just, you know, the world still being based around white guys who grew up in cul-de-sacs.
Right. And there was a lot of that, like, to a certain extent, that I feel like that grew out of, like, the 80s on some level. And sort of, I don't know, like P.J. O'Rourke, like that, all that stuff.
Well, there's always going to be a backlash, and the reactionaries never willfully give up a piece of turf. That's why we now have a civil rights movement for bigots. You know, they just won't give up. When you beat them, you know, you have to hold the ground. And we often think, oh, okay, well, everybody's sort of on board here. Give it some time, and they'll find ways to come back at you. I think that will certainly happen with, you know, a lot of the progress we've made on issues concerning sexuality, gender, so on and so forth.
You know, it's funny. The other day I was at occasionally I go on MSNBC to do some talking head segment.
Right, right.
And I was on and I was in the wings of the set when Judith Miller was walking off the set with Chris Hayes. And the first thing I thought about was what I think it was the title of your book, even. And that story that you told. Tell that story, because it literally, that resonated in my mind.
Okay, so I'm at CNN one day in, like, 88. And I'm in the green room, and I'm talking to Norma Quarles, who was an anchor there. She's getting ready to go on in an hour or something. And I'm getting ready to go on. And just then, and she's being very courteous with me, and we're having a conversation. I'm sort of standing up and pacing around because it's what I do before I do any sort of performance. And all of a sudden, she just looks right past me and immediately gets inordinately obsequious. Oh, hello, doctor. How are you? And I turn around and I see this person, and it doesn't register right away who it is, but I just go, ugh. And I start bootlegging around, and then a second later, I realize it's Henry Kissinger. It's Henry Kissinger. And at first I'm going like, why? To myself, I'm actually thinking, why would you immediately hate him? Oh, it's Henry Kissinger. So I bootleg around the room. Kissinger's sort of by the door. So just to go to the far side of the doorway and to walk out of the room, you know, I bootleg all the way around the room and walk out and at the door, and Kissinger's sort of just standing there kind of like idling like a satanic water cooler, just and so Kissinger extends his claw to me and says, "Hello, I'm Henry Kissinger," and I just look at him and go, "Ugh," and walk out of the room. And the next thing you know, this big phalanx of security comes up and whatever, because it's a big threat to Henry Kissinger if you don't want to suck up to him or shake his hand because he's high ranking in the cult of personality and let's forget about everything else. But you know, I wasn't going to do that. So after everything clears, and they take Kissinger into a special other room and with all the security and stuff, I could walk back in, and Norma Quarles says to me, why didn't you want to shake hands with Dr. Kissinger? And I said, because I have a strict policy of never shaking hands with war criminals. And she says, oh, that's right, I forgot. Well, I didn't, Norma. So, anyway, that's what
and
happened.
We should say she forgot not that you had that policy, but that Henry Kissinger was a war criminal.
Yeah, I believe that was the case. It might be. I don't think she knew my policies. But
well, yeah. I got to say, that makes me feel a little bit better, because I was feeling guilty for not saying it to Judith Miller's face, because I literally turned my back when she came through, which I don't know if she was savvy enough to realize, like, that's weird. He's in a 3-foot hallway.
I think he's got to be pretty used to it.
Yeah.
But it's amazing that she gets to come back.
Yes.
It's amazing that when they go over all this stuff and they realize all the mistakes in the Gulf Wars and whatever, you know, they bring back all the people who were wrong, and they're, well, no one really knew at the time. Well, me and 10,000 people on the Boston Common knew, you know.
I agree.
So,
all right, so
you could not, you know, I mean, turning your back to her, you don't have to make a big deal out of it, but just, I'm not touching you. I mean, the towards Kissinger was just a natural reaction, like, get that thing away from me. I don't want to touch you.
So let's talk a little bit about the movie. Like, I really want people to be able to see this, and we're linking, obviously, to Call Me Lucky, the movie .com, and there are screenings, I know, in, I guess, in June in Detroit and Ann Arbor at the Cinetopia Film Festival. And
7th in Detroit, 13th and 14th in Ann Arbor, I believe.
And then the 26th of June at the Free State Film Festival in Lawrence, Kansas.
Right, and the 24th we're at the BAM Cinema Fest in Brooklyn.
Oh, really?
Brooklyn Academy of Music, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I didn't realize that at all. That's not on the on the website yet. So,
Yeah, but I'm not in charge of that. But,
right.
Yeah, it's yeah, so we're going to be in Brooklyn, and that's fun. And then after that, and there'll be an announcement about how more people will be able to see it in the relatively near future.
Okay, good. And I just want to tell people.
And we've done great. We went to Sundance, and there were, you know, 5 sold-out shows and standing ovations after every show, and it's just, and the critics were incredibly generous. And then we received the best documentary at Boulder, best doc at Gasparilla in Tampa, audience choice at Chattanooga for best overall film, best doc by the audience at the Independent Film Festival Boston, and then most recently the Chicago Critics Film Festival. We received the audience again chose this as the best film of the festival. So
I'm not surprised.
Well.
I mean, I should just tell people it is a film that Bob Goldthwait made about you, and it's I mean, it was particularly fascinating for me because you know, knowing you, knowing most of the people in the film, at least the comedians,
right.
You know, having been sort of like a younger generation, and all of these, right. Most of these people, you know, people I who were, you know, sort of the that's what comedy was when I was in Boston.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it, you know, I don't know how much, you want to reveal about the film.
Well, you know, I mean, it's not, listen, I don't think it should be like, it's not like you're spoiling, you know,
right.
a narrative film.
Right.
It's
okay.
a film. And, you know, people should, I think people should know, and Bob said this, people should know that, it, among other things, it's about me surviving child abuse and how I dealt with it. And the reason it's called Call Me Lucky is because I feel very fortunate that I, who knows if I'd been abused a few more times or whatever, what would have happened to me? You know, I became a human rights activist rather than a human rights offender. So I'm really fortunate, you know. And then you look at that film and you see all these friends I have, and there's so many more like you who I would love to have in it. But as I tell everybody, it was Bob's film. It's just about me. You know, I mean, I'm just extraordinarily fortunate. You know, I had a really tough thing happen to me early on in life, and it cost me a lot of time. But once I had the opportunity to do something about it, I did. And a big part of my healing was working on behalf of contemporary children and started learning to get out of my own way.
Well, that was the part that, I mean, now I was there that night where you first talked about this on stage.
And yeah, it was we're doing a benefit for the Southern Poverty Law Center,
right.
While Los Angeles was still smoking.
That's right. You know? That's right. And so I was trying to figure out what that benefit was off the top of my head. I could not remember. And in Cross Comedy, we had done some sketches, and you came up, and it was, I mean, I am still getting goosebumps. It was one of the most poignant, I mean, obviously, it's a different experience for you than me. But for me, it's sitting in that audience to see that level of honesty and to see you work through that pain was a really intense experience. And what
I only talked about it publicly that one time, and then didn't do it for another year until I wrote a piece with Phoenix, Boston Phoenix, about it. But that night, it just seemed to me, with all these people really denigrating these kids in Los Angeles, you know, I just felt it was important to try to say, you know, there's context here that we need to understand. You know, and as I've come on, gone on to learn or really articulate better, and that is that when people behave, you know, in what looks to be an insane way, there's often reasons for it. And if you can get back to the source, there's sanity at the source. This seemingly crazy behavior, if you look at it in the context of where this person's coming from, suddenly becomes ingenious. It's a survival mechanism. You know, they're just hanging on, and this is all they can come up with, and they're trying. You know, you got to get past that point. You got to. I mean, it's really important to get through, go through things and not around them. However, you know, it makes it easier to not take everybody so personally. You know, because often when somebody's just irrational with you or whatever, they're just telling you something about them, not
right.
You know, not you. They're telling you about some kind of pain or problem they have.
I distinctly remember that night when you, as a way of entering into, you know, telling people in this room, and you know, and it was in a comedy club. It wasn't, you know, not a 1,000 seat venue, but it was, you know, there was a couple of hundred people in there at least. It was full, definitely full, and
yeah.
And I remember you saying that people asked you why you were so. I can't remember exactly, you know, I'm obviously paraphrasing, but why it was so important for you to do your comedy and to fight on behalf of.
Yeah, the unspoken for it. Forever I thought it was because I was a kid from a wealthy town, not a wealthy kid, but at least I grew up in a wealthy town with a lot of advantages in upstate New York. And I just thought I had, you know, I just thought I felt guilty about that or whatever. But, I mean, it turns out the compassion, the tuning fork for compassion was deeply seated in me because I knew what it was to be oppressed. I knew what it was to be almost killed, you know. So I realized that for years I went out and spoke for the unspoken for. And when the time came and it turned out I was one of those people, I had a choice to either be a hypocrite or tell my story. And fortunately, I chose to tell my story, and I think right now, even all these 20 plus years later, Bobcat makes this beautiful film, and I think it's helping some people. You know, I know it is because I've talked to them, and I'm dealing with them.
Well, I mean, there are people in the film who talk about how you directly touched their lives in that accord. And the thing that I didn't know was, and because I think this is when I had left Boston for a while, and that. Within a year or two from there, when you had moved to Cleveland, the footage of you giving testimony in front of that Senate hearing is really unbelievable. I mean, and what AOL was doing at the time was really unbelievable. Just
they
talk about that exchange.
They were profiteering on child pornography trading. And you have to understand that back then, this was 1995, you know, it costs $3 or $4 an hour to be on AOL if you're on over a certain amount of time. And a normal person, that would end up costing you $100 or $200 to be on AOL if you were pushing it. Well, these people were all spending, you know, $1,000, $1,200 a month on AOL, and there were hundreds of them. And it was because when exchanging these files of child pornography, which is photographic evidence of sexual assaults and abuse of children, and it's not kiddie porn, which sounds like the Bunny Hill or something. It's photographic evidence. As I said in the hearing, I wish everyone could see it. I wish no one could see it. But once you see it, you're transformed. I mean, you're either a creep or you're transformed, you know. And someone told me about these rooms, these member rooms on AOL, and I wander in, and instantly, without even saying anything, people start sending me files of child pornography, like as a quote-unquote good faith measure, expecting me to return my collection to them. Well, with the 2.88 baud modem, or even the 5.6, whatever they were, 56, it took forever to upload one picture. So these people were spending a fortune, and AOL knew this. And I kept approaching them about it in good faith for months, and then I just realized, I just figured it out, followed the money, and realized that they were doing it because there was, you know, a lot of money in it. So the cornerstone of that organization, as far as I was concerned, was, you know, covered in blood. And, I mean, if you see these photos, and they were just photos, you can just about see the humanity, you know, wafting out away from these children's eyes. I mean, it's really terrible. There's one image, I mention it in the movie, of a curly-haired very distinctive-looking kid. He's getting raped by this curly-haired guy who looks exactly like him. It's clearly a family member. And one of AOL's big things was, well, we have parental guidelines on there. Like, what if the parent's doing the rape, you know? They were just, you know, trying to dodge. But at one point, finally, what you don't get in the movie, but it was far into the hearing, and I had landed a lot of blows on this lawyer for AOL, and he was a little punch drunk, and finally says, look, I want to make it clear, we have a strict three strikes and you're out policy concerning child pornography. And I just said, you know, basically, yeah, I love baseball, but come on. It's a one-strike offense in any league.
When I came in this morning and was talking to my producers about the film, and because that, you know, that was the one part that I knew nothing about, that exchange, right, and your role in really, I mean, fundamentally changing. Because if that doesn't happen at that time, and you also introduced some cops to the idea that even who didn't even have computers at that time of what was going on there, but that the idea that AOL would have had a three strikes and you're out policy for child pornography is unimaginable now.
And their representative says this.
Yeah, that's their stated policy. And, you know, that you know, if you believe that they're actually adhering to it, and it's not designed just to escape accountability for those people, that's unbelievable. And here's the thing, though, is I'm convinced that that would have been precedent setting had you not been...
No, we have zero tolerance about crimes committed by teenagers, but we have three strikes if there's, you know, about crimes committed against children.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah. And so let me, I mean, ask you, you know, and so...
And by the way, I'd like to point out, too, that I'm, with all this and whatever, I'm not some, you know, I'm glad to say I didn't become some reactionary about this. I don't believe you should kill people who do commit these crimes. They should be segregated from children. But and I certainly don't believe in the death penalty. There's another thing. I get a little floaty when I talk about this sometimes, but I'll get back to it. Go ahead, Sam.
Well, one of the things that you do that if people follow you on Twitter, is that you, it seems, I think it is, on a daily basis, you make a request of the Pope.
For excommunication, yes.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, say that again.
For excommunication, yes. Their big threat is they're going to excommunicate you. Well, I grew up as Catholic and suffered a lot of emotional abuse at the hands of an awful priest who turns out I was the only kid who got, everybody else begged off of having to serve these early masses every day. I had to go in there. So I lived near the church, and, you know, I basically served every morning mass for, you know, years at a time. And I mean, these are weekday masses. And it'd be a small group of people there, and this priest who just hated me and did everything he could to drive me out because he had profiled me. You know, he put his hands on me, and I hit him with an elbow twice, three times. And then, you know, he tried to get me in his car, and I never let him. And so he knew, and plus I think he was afraid of my father. And so he knew the pond wasn't stocked as long as I was there. So he did everything he could every day on an altar to drive me away while these parishioners sat there and watched. You know, and I mean, this guy's literally condemning me to hell. I pour the water on his hand. Are you trying to drown me? And just like whatever it was. But often mentioning that I, you know, it's blasphemous to have this hellbound child on the altar with me. And so if you wonder why I have some problems with authority, it might start by getting denigrated on an altar every day. But later on...
And so his plan was to get you to...
Thomas Mary was one of the most savage pedophiles who harmed countless children. And I know a lot of his victims. In fact, I know of three who committed suicide. And so, you know, he died in, like, right after the turn of the century. And when I talked to my buddies who survived his most savage abuse, we say we're in the Hell Alumni Association. And, you know, when we mention Neri now, two words come to mind, extra crispy. So.
Right. Well, so wait a second. So he was basically trying to get you to quit so that so that some other potential victim would take your place.
Yes. And so then one day I'm watching the news from New York, and Dolan's on. He's just the bishop at the see. He hasn't been a cardinal yet. And this is before all the stuff came out about what he did in Milwaukee to cover up and hide money and commit financial crimes to keep the victims of these kids from the deaf school. They made a wonderful documentary about called Mea Maxima Culpa. Well, they hid all this money. He got caught. There's a paper trail, whatever. If they caught the CEO of IBM doing this, the guy would be taken away in shackles.
Right.
This guy's the cardinal and probably one of the leading voices in the Catholic Church in this country. Well, anyway, he gets up that day and talks about the last pope and says, it's about time someone stood up for the poor last pope, who, by the way, ran the office where, because the Vatican is an independent state, made so by Benito Mussolini in a sleazy deal in, I believe, 1929. They can, all they had to do was put a bunch of evidence in diplomatic pouches, fly it to the Vatican, and then, Ratzinger or whatever his name would review it. And he kept a lid on everything for a while. And then I think he literally became pope because, I've kept control of this far, but if somebody else becomes pope, I don't know what will happen, right. You be pope. So anyway, Dolan gets up and gives this impassioned defense of Ratzinger. And afterwards, they're interviewing all the parishioners outside. They go, it's about time someone stood up for the poor Holy Father. And I was... that's when I just tied the whole thing together. These people, these are the same kind of people who sat and watched this son of a bitch abuse me on an altar every day. And had they said something, how many other children would have been saved from far worse? And I got to listen to them talk about this as if the victim here is the Pope who covered it up for years. Yeah, give me a break. So, yeah, excommunicate me. That's their big threat. Good. I'll know I'm in hell if there's a bunch of bishops and popes there.
Yeah.
By the way, the new guy, it's his job to change the subject and not the church. Everything, he's done nothing about the abuse scandal except buy time and tell and send emissaries to the UN hearing on torture in Geneva that child rape isn't torture and to say that he's not responsible for any priests who aren't at the Vatican.
Interesting.
So you're a mayor, okay? Why do you get all this ink then?
Let me ask you, do you...
And by the way, his PR guy, Greg Burke, former Fox News Fox News correspondent at the Vatican.
Oh, geez.
He's the guy who sold us and shaped this whole campaign on what a progressive he is. So you take that for what it's worth. But Greg Burke, who belongs to Opus Dei.
Fascinating. That's a take you just don't hear.
I love the band.
Right, exactly.
A little bit softer now.
Wow, that's fascinating. I had no idea about that. About the sort
so
of
yeah, record. Go ahead, excommunicate me. I demand it.
They haven't. There's a great cartoon in the animation in the film about the Pope reacting.
Another genius thing. Go for it. I mean, I put my life. I put my life in Goldthwait's hands, and I made a wise choice.
Yeah, the film is really it's incredibly moving, and it's really amazing. And let me ask you this: and I know in some ways I know that you answer the question, and it's in the title of the film. But
yeah.
I mean, do you have times where you feel like obviously your life would have been different if? If it didn't intersect with that life of that guy who, that criminal.
Yeah, who died in prison, my rapist when I was four.
There's
a degree of that, but I'd let it, I don't know. If there is some grand reason to this, I can't really understand why this happens to any children, but if it had to happen to any of them, or it's happening to a lot of them, I don't know, maybe there's a reason I was one of them because, I didn't die. I survived, and I'm someone who had, for years before I dealt with my own stuff, learned how to tell audiences about things they weren't necessarily there to hear, So I feel like I have some purpose there, and so that's okay. And as far as the rest of it's concerned, you know, a lot of people go through a lot of stuff, and we don't hear about it, and we don't know about it. And I, you know, one of the things I'm very fortunate about was I was able to work through what happened to me as a child and move on with my life and get to be a bunch of other things. I'm not just a child abuse survivor. I'm a political satirist, an activist in a lot of causes. I'm a guy who chops his own firewood. You know, I have dogs and girlfriend and, you know, like, things are great. So that's just one element of me. But sometimes something will catch you from the wrong angle, or something will hit you, or you hear a story or something, and it comes back. And I just, that's like, I have a big hunk of scar tissue in me, and once in a while you turn the wrong way, and ooh, that hurts. But, you know, I know what it is, and I know it will pass, and I know that maybe I'm going to get something from that that I can employ to try to do some good. So it's okay.
Well, you know, a lot of what I do is a function of having intersected with you 20-some-odd years ago. And I know that's true for a lot of comedians in my generation. I mean, people who have been influenced by you. And I really do think that, you know, I think we're living in an era where we're seeing comedians who are far more willing than they were 5, 10, 15 years ago come out and get involved in speak their mind in terms of politics. I think a lot of that, really genuinely, I believe this, is a function of being younger and seeing you do it years ago. And I really do sincerely believe that, and I just wanted to let you know that.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll just skip it back to Lenny Bruce and Smothers Brothers and Mark Twain and a bunch of people who showed me the same thing, you know.
And so I also wanted to say, you got to get a wider mall for your wood shop.
You know what? I got to tell you about that. My leg was broken because they wanted the shots. So I said, I'll give it a shot. And when I go, this isn't working, it was because I'm standing on my left leg trying to swing. I hadn't gone to split a piece of firewood that didn't split in 8 years. And then they rolled the film, it's conk, conk.
I thought your form was a little bit off on that, I got to say. And I was first thing that occurred to me is like, he's splitting it with an axe, not a maul.
My knee was broken in two places, like,
oh, jeez.
Like, 8 weeks before that or something. And so maybe it was 12. But anyway, it was still hurting. And it was like the wind chill was in the 20s below that day. So it was really hurting. And and we did that after he had me haul that log up the hill.
With a broken leg?
Yeah, it was getting better, but it was still there.
Wow. Well, people have to see the movie to know what we're talking about. But Barry, yeah. Where are you? Are you touring at all? Are you?
I'm going to, and I'm looking. I'm working towards. I got a couple more film fests to do. I'm finishing up a book for Seven Stories Press right now, and between now and the middle of June, I have that, and then in the middle of June, we have three more film festivals to do, and then after that, I'm going to go out and start doing some dates, working towards shooting a special next winter.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you'll come back onto the program soon, and people can check out what you're doing. We'll link to it at Barry Crimmins. It's BarryCrimmins.com, right?
Yes, absolutely. BarryCrimmins.com or at Crimmins on Twitter or Barry Crimmins on Facebook. You can find me, and please check in. And I'll tell you what, Sam, I'm thrilled and really flattered that what you had to say, and I'm glad that I was a good influence on such a good person who does such good work.
Thank you, Barry.
I'm proud of you, kiddo.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. And I hope everybody gets a chance to see Call Me Lucky, and all praise to Bobcat Goldthwait.
Indeed. Barry Crimmins, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, sir.
Bye. The movie was really, moving. It was obviously seeing people that I knew and having been part of, just coincidentally, you know, Cross Comedy was doing that that benefit. We had done, I don't know, three or four sketches, and Barry came in. And I didn't mention this to Barry, but there was, his drinking is pretty legendary, and it's talked about in the program. And one night, when John Benjamin and I were living in Somerville, I doubt Barry remembers this evening. I mean, for reasons which will be clear as I explain. One, because it was, I think, much bigger deal for me to be hanging out with Barry than it was for Barry to be hanging out with me. But Cross brought him over, and he had a case of beer and I think a bottle of wine. And he's like, you know, I brought this case of beer. And we're like, oh, great. And he goes, no, this is for me. And we were like, oh, that's fine, because we had a ton of beer, too. And literally, Cross left at one point, but we just sat in our living room. There wasn't much to do. We didn't, you know, in our living room, we just sat there and drank. And Barry just told us stories of, you know what, and next time we'll do this. But I think Barry told me the story about his sitcom. Oh, my gosh. Next time, remind me. Because he, now this is all coming back to me. He told Benjamin and I a story about his time he almost did a sitcom. And I think he said, like, don't tell anybody this. And, you know, I think the statute of limitations is over. But I had forgotten about that. I'm going to rack my brain about what that is. But it was quite a night. I mean, it really, I don't know if I mentioned this on the show the other day, but, you know, basically my life from like around that time until the early aughts was, you know, I was a single guy drinking a lot, doing a lot of different things, traveling and meeting a bunch of people. I don't remember a lot from that period, frankly. Now I can remember like what I had for lunch 6 years ago or what color spoon I ate my yogurt with like 3.5 years ago on a Tuesday. But I don't have a lot of memories from like a 10-year period. And that night, I really sticks out for me. It was a big deal to be sitting, you know, he was a very influential, an influential guy. Not like that he had influence. He was influential on a lot of people who were in his sort of atmosphere, his orbit, I guess. And, I mean, I don't think from his perspective I was in his orbit, but from my perspective I was. You know, you don't – you're much more conscious of that. But, I mean, a lot of the comedy that I started to do the first comedy I did, or the second, was much more explicitly political. And then at one point, I, like Barry said, it didn't get you very far. Particularly at that time, you know, comedians are a lot more political today than they were. Broadly speaking, I'm talking about successful comedians. There was a time, like he said, you know, Lenny Bruce, and the Smothers Brothers were pretty political. But then, during that '80s. 90s period, there was just too much money to be made if you could fit into a slot, broadly.
And can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
What is, like, I don't know if you could explain this, but so he talked about that experience on stage. So what was it that actually led up? Like, how did that happen? Well, I mean, I got some sense of it.
Some of it's in the movie, and some of it from recollection.
Just listening to in terms of the interview.
I think he was the one who was setting up, if I'm not mistaken, he set up this. He was probably working with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which I wasn't terribly familiar with in Boston as like a 25-year-old or whatever it was. Cross Comedy came in and, you know, it was a benefit. And we did some sketches, and I think maybe Cross functioned as the host. I'm not exactly sure. I don't remember. And we did our sketches. We were sitting in the back of the room drinking. Barry came up, talked about the organization, talked about you know, he introduced it by saying, you know, people ask me why, and he said, and recently I've come to understand it. It was, his sister is interviewed in the documentary, and I think she had some recollection, and I think it was something that he had not been aware of. And maybe, you know, now he would say like he was vaguely aware of it, or I don't know. But at the time when he talked about it, it was only starting to come back to him. And that's, you know, I think that's, you know, and I think you see, look, it's not terribly surprising, particularly for comedians like Barry, or like, you know, a guy like Marin, let's say, who I think was also, you know, very much influenced, who will work stuff out on stage. And so it was, but, and now that I recall, and this guy I think is in the movie, Steve Sweeney came up, who was a comedian who was not necessarily like that. I mean, he was a guy that, you know, I think had a tremendous amount of respect for Barry, but he came up and I remember Sweeney. I mean, can you imagine being a comedian to follow that? Sweeney came up there and I was just like, I don't think I got very funny jokes right now.
So. Like, so got a new TV last week.
No, he, yeah, I mean, that was the thing.
What are you going to do?
I actually, you know, there were some of us who were comedians from Catch a Rising Star, and that was in Harvard Square. And though none of us were from Harvard, that was the type of comedy that we did. We did comedy that, and it's what it's, I mean, I'm talking in my generation and slightly older than me. We're doing comedy that was what ultimately been known in the early 90s and mid 90s as alt comedy. And a lot of the stuff we were doing across comedy at that time was specifically in reaction to the comedy that was brick wall, microphone, stand up in front of it, do 8 minutes, and it's on those Ha Network and Comedy Channel, I think it was called at the time. And there were comedians in Boston who would play like, was like, rooms that would play to, you know, certain percentage of people in Boston are meatheads. We do that. And Barry was one of those guys who sort of existed before any of that divide took place. And I think Lenny Clark in the movie, and if you're aware of Lenny Clark, the idea of Lenny Clark and Barry Crimmins being friends, it's hard to sort of get your head around, but it was a function of Barry, you know, sort of being this force and setting up the opportunity for people at the Ding Ho. The Ding Ho is very sort of famous in comedy.
Is that's the Chinese place across from Harvard? Or
no,
which, is that
no
the
that's the
studio?
Hong Kong. The Ding Ho, that's the comedy studio. Oh, okay. Ding Ho is in Inman Square.
Okay. And, all right.
And it's even when I was there 20 years ago, Ding Ho was gone. I lived in Inman Square, and it was a Chinese restaurant, but it wasn't. The Ding Ho was gone at that point. And that's where, like, Stephen Wright came out of. Jay Leno, I think, was there. I think Paula Poundstone, definitely. Gosh, it's where like comedy was in many respects like born in like that wave of comedy, and so Barry was friends with, you know, with those guys in a way where I think, like, certainly in my generation, those guys, their comedy was a little bit, I don't know, just sort of pedestrian's not the right word, but we definitely sort of felt like, pff. And Sweeney was, you know, one of those guys, very Boston. And, but the way he responded to that, I thought was incredibly, it was a tough situation. And he was basically like, was very moved by it and expressed that on stage, and that was atypical for him.
So there were comedians who were like that. That's great.
All right. Wow, it's 1:35 already.
Was a gut wrenching thing to listen to.
Well, the film is really moving. and fascinating. I mean, both, you know, both in both sort of, if you're interested in comedy or activism or just humanity, I really, you know, for a while I've had the idea of having Barry on. I don't know why we didn't have him on, like, say, 2 or 3 years ago. But since I knew the film was in production, I was like, let's wait for the film to come out. And then at one point I was like, I don't want to wait anymore. Basically what it came down to. And so we'll have him back on when people have more access to the film. All right. Let's go to the fun half. I'm going to put... Because we're going to go do another half hour, probably. I don't want Freebie Friday with 2 hours. Forget about it. Although, I guess, hold on. Stop the music. We're not going to do a show on Monday.
Oh, okay.
But you know what? Forget it. Start the music up again. All right. Stop the music. No, we got to go into the fun half to do the competition where you get the picture of Michael through... look at he's doing it now! All right. 646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, we're going to be taking off on Memorial Day.
A rare
day
occurrence.
Off. Yes, where we have no programming whatsoever. Have a good weekend. If you know a vet, or if you know, you don't, I mean, thank them for their service. You know, when we talk about Iraq, I think it was during that war that I think I became a little bit more conscious of, in many respects, our military are victims of our civilian leadership and of people who would send them into that situation. And I think that's important to remember. You get past the jingoism, you're talking about people who, you know, in so many ways, swindled. All right, we'll be back in just a moment.